Good morning, everyone.
Well, at least it's good morning here. I don't know what it is where on which part of the globe, but probably I think I should come up with a good opening speech or that introduction and probably add some music to it so that it'll be pretty standard. And yeah, I think I should do it. Well, with that being established, I think it's now time to move on to the podcast. Welcome to the Voice of Daniel. You're listening to the podcast of Sports Scientist. So today, I'm going to discuss about something called as overtraining. I'm pretty sure most of the athletes would have heard this. But it's not only with the athletes, it's also with the general population, that's the gym-going population as well. You don't train too much just to see and just to expect, in fact, expect bigger results just because you train a lot. Your body is again a machine, and then it could take only so much that you throw on them. So it's about overtraining and how much is too much. Deciding the quantity is a major step for coaches and trainers. Volume, load, intensity, frequency, well, all these terminologies have always been a cumbersome process as it is largely dependent on each individual's adaptations and response pattern. The scale moves too less, then we call it detraining, and if it moves too much, it's called overtraining. That's what it is in a nutshell. Well, let's now focus on deducing the appropriate much of training. It's quite a pressure that's put on the coach's head. Especially in a team sport scenario, the coaches should monitor each athlete individually under numerous circumstances. With popular sports such as cricket or football, it becomes very hectic to do such monitoring due to frequent matches. Also, the training periods are pretty tightly scheduled. Thus, the coaches are forced to compel their athletes into more intense and rigorous training regimes. The scenario on extreme levels leads to something that's called as overtraining syndrome. Overtraining. Overtraining is a phenomenon that appears in as a result of imbalance between training and recovery levels. With persistent hardcore training protocols, the athlete might strain so much that his exercise levels would exceed the body's ability to recover within the given recovery time frame. This would result in a significant decline or a plateau in athlete's performance. Monotonous programs, high volumes, and unmonitored intensities can predispose the athlete to overtraining syndrome. It causes a reduced lack of stimulus in the central nervous system and thus would reduce the strength and fitness levels of the athlete. It's very important to keep this in mind. When the overtraining syndrome is unidentified and/or it's not considered or probably ignored, it leads to extreme levels, even including exertional rhabdomyolysis. Though uncommon, I don't think it's worth to have it and under a probability of ignorance. Overtraining syndrome can appear in numerous mechanisms. Each athlete may develop the chain in an astonishingly different scale and level. There are no orderly revelation of the mechanism or even signs or symptoms in a hierarchy. I have mentioned below some of the common modes that they set in, and as said, these do not refer to any hierarchy or orders, but we can expect either of them in either of the orders. The possible mechanisms would include muscle microtrauma that occurs as a result of repeated use of the particular muscle without proper and adequate amount of recovery. It can also pop in as protein deficiency, where the amino acids are used up in a quicker rate than the supply. It can also come from an incomplete protein diet, especially prevalent among vegans. Activated release of cytokines are also a huge complementing factor for underperformance. Diet preferences of the athlete, as I said, vegans have a concept of complementary protein. Improper training protocols and even sympathetic nervous system goes into override, which results in elevating the heart rate and increase adrenaline levels relatively quicker than the unacclimatized population. This would adversely decline the performance as the flight or fight protocol gets activated. Well, then you might ask me, how would we then figure out if my athlete is in appropriate training regimen or is he being overtrained? Well, though it's hard to orderly place the signs and symptoms in a particular hierarchy, the signs and symptoms by itself are very classic towards it. So few of the common signs and symptoms can be easily observable. The most vivid sign would be in the performance by itself. Another classical observance would be an altered resting heart rate. Well, most of the athletes have a habit of using fitness trackers and checking their heart rates regularly. So it's this one is also a point to the coach. You can ask them if their heart rate is being elevated or are there any unexplained changes in the resting heart rate by itself. If your athlete is portraying delayed or longer periods of muscle soreness, beware. This is also a sign that he might be in the initial stages of the syndrome. Other classical signs would include the following, you know, increased risk of injury, increased rate of injury, early onset of fatigue, reduced VO2 max, delayed recovery levels, instant or inconsistent muscle soreness and fatigue, elevated resting heart rate, reduced immunity, psychological changes, even loss of focus, loss of sleep, and sometimes it can also present as insatiable thirst. Quite surprisingly, the prevalence of the syndrome is quite less in the international teams than the state, country, or even the college teams. What's it with the coaches? It's quite surprising that the coaches and the trainers who train the state, country, county, or even college team prepare the athletes in a more strenuous way than the international team players are trained. Various studies have pointed out that there is large incidences of overtraining syndrome in state, county, and even college level cricket players. And also very less cases have been reported in the international cricket players. It is also possible that the coaches are responsible for the injuries and poor performance scales at the sub-international levels even. This would result in spoiling the athlete's career at such an early stage itself. It's immensely critical to realize that the coaches must analyze their workout pattern with respect to each of the individual in the team. The head coaches and the strength and conditioning professional must understand the fact that just because you train them more and you train them hard, it simply doesn't mean that it would impact the performance in a relatively similar positive way. In reality, the anticlimax is more likely to happen in a scenario where you don't monitor your training loads and volumes very frequently with each and every individual athlete you train. Well, personally, I have done research that statistically shows that the county players in England had a statistical drop in their performance after just 1 year of cricket training. This can largely be attributed to the fact that at sub-international levels, the training levels are very much crazier than sensible. Well, no offense, but that's what even science and numbers said when I did the research. Well, then, since I've touched the coach's point of view, now most of the coaches may question me, then how much do I train my athlete? You tell if I don't train him enough, he goes into detraining. If I train him too much, he goes into overtraining. Then how much is the exact much? Well, this is the note to the coaches. How much you train your athlete is entirely a decision that you need to make based on your observation with your client. One of your athlete may have higher thresholds than the other in the same team and the same age criteria even. One simple way I tend to propose, or I would dare to propose, is to load them individually based on their VO2 max levels for aerobic and RPE scales for other exercises. I think it's very important to respect athlete's feelings of his perceived exertion. Though we know that he might not be there yet, we still don't know if he is there yet as well. So it's quite a good thing to respect his RPE as well. RPE stands for rate of perceived exertion, by the way. Well, it is rare instances that coaches don't use 1RM for resistance exercises. Almost everyone in the industry is boasting about their utility of 1RM in their protocols and stuff. By the way, 1RM is also very handy and a common method to train your athlete, and I'm not stating otherwise at all. It is just nice to clear out the point that just following one simple scientific term doesn't mean that you train your athlete with science senses. Please do not do this. Do not just use a small part of science as a big part of your training and screening protocols and claim that you have been training with the base of sports science. You can take the support of sports science experts at many regards with this concern. Focus on training frequencies and try working your way around to derive on the expected load and intensity. This should reduce the training volume and probably thus would directly promote recovery, which in turn reduces the possibility of overtraining syndrome and even instances of injuries. Introduce variations, introduce differences in the program. This would prevent monotony in the system. As discussed earlier, monotonous patterns increase the rate of adaptation to the workout, and thus this would then result in reduced stimulus and thus the training effects. Introduction of new stimulus is done because if not introduced, the body gets adapted to the exercises and further improvement in performance would be ceased or plateaued. Also, once the body is adapted to the progression of the training, then it would seem easy for the athlete and the coach would then have to increase the volume and or as a combination of volume and load. This would then bring us back to square zero, which we don't want to happen. The problem is we have begun coaching as a mode of education and have been following literatures which dates back few decades or even, I wouldn't dare say centuries, but a lot of decades back from now. The researchers have updated many useful changes, and due to controversies, we are unaware of what to follow and what not, when to follow and why not. Eventually, we are stuck back to the older and widely accepted concepts. Coaches can try combining different forms of training to prevent monotony and muscular or systemic resistance. Example, you can include fartlek training and interval training for the first cycle and combine continuous training with training at lactate threshold for the another cycle. I have explained more about these types of common trainings in another podcast. I have named it as training with types. So you should probably check that out as well if you don't have an idea of what we are talking about. Many are aware and a few are not aware of the 7 principles of training. Coaches must begin to exploit them in greater extent. As a matter of fact, these have been highly evidential for a couple of years from now. Since now, I mean. So what are these 7 principles of training? So they are specificity, progressive overload, individuality, variations or periodization, maintenance, FITT, which stands for frequency, interval, type and time, and reversibility. I would say all are equally informative and important, but the part of specificity is something that we should all reassign our focus onto with this topic in concern. The specificity principle states that adaptations to the metabolic and physiological functions depend upon the type and mode of the overload. That is, specific exercises elicits specific adaptations to promote specific training effects, and there is only a limited exchange or interchange of benefits within these things. The principle also advises that the training should be in such a way that it's specific to each sport, each individual, and ultimately increases the demand of improvement of specific systems. According to this principle, training adaptations are highly specific to the type of activity and to the volume and intensity of the exercise period. As a remedy to these signs and symptoms, the common reflex by the sports science team and few coaches is to give rest and put them off the ground. This is literally the most inappropriate response to be given to the body that has been doing enormous amounts of workout over a period of time. The outcome of immediate complete rest would push the body into drastic responses that even the body itself wouldn't be able to understand. And some coaches do not monitor the players at rest or recovery phase even. They can relapse into the other extreme of the training abscess called the detraining. It occurs as a result of not training over a longer period of time. It is more appropriate to suggest recreational activities or you know, you can phase it as active rest periods. Coaches should reduce the regimen in a very logical and definitely not in an exponential pattern. Encourage them to engage in other activities so that they don't fall into that phase of detraining. This must never be confused or interfered with the brief recovery periods that are given to athletes despite them not displaying any signs of overtraining syndrome. This is done quite short periods before competitions or main events. This is actually another technique that most of the coaches and even the SNCs use. This is called tapering. This is actually used to pump up the muscle glycogen store and promote full and quick recovery just prior to competition. This is often combined with the supplementations as well. So the whole agenda is to promote and bulk up your muscle glycogen levels and your energy producing system levels. Mostly done with supplementations, and that would actually push me to my next podcast, which will be on supplementations. So we have come to the end, and as usual, my end quote of this podcast would be, well, coaches must understand the fact that just because you train them more and hard, it doesn't mean it would impact the performance in a relatively similar manner. The relationship will be inverse. You train a person so much, so hard, beyond his recovery levels, then it's indirectly you putting him into risk of injury, reduced performance, and even finishing off his career for him. Well, so this is what I think you have to keep in mind. And yes, as a budding sports science team, I always say this, as a budding sports science team, we need to have an open view on new researches and then try acclimatizing that things are going to come new and we have to try and make use of them. Because even if there is a single chance in promoting the performance of an athlete or a team, I think we shouldn't stop them from it. We need to have a wide knowledge on different areas of expertise, and then we need to have a confidence to say to our team at least that if that particular training technique or any particular advancement in that technology would apply to our team in our nation and or in our level of experiences. So thank you everyone for listening to this podcast, and I also encourage you to go and see the pictorial representations that I put on my blog. So I've given the link in the descriptions of my podcast channel. So just pop in, click in, and then have a read through and try sharing knowledge as much as possible. So this is Nims signing off from the Sports Scientist podcast, and see you until my next podcast. Have a good day.